Hello, my name's Brian Dwyer, and this is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. Tonight's feature is John Banville's The Untouchable. More about that soon. With me in the studio tonight, Lynn Halloran from Galapagos Books, Robin Tidball from the Apollo Bay School, Kathy Donovan, well known to U3A members, and at the microphone, Deb Bradfield and Megan Harrison. Hello, ladies. How are you?
Good evening. Pretty cool.
Yes, on this winter solstice. And what have you been reading, Deb?
Well, I've just started one, and I've actually never heard his name pronounced, so I might have it wrong. The book's called The Buried Giant by Kazuo Ishiguro. I'm only about 40 pages into it, so I'm not really sure what I'm thinking about it yet. But it's a bit of a slightly fantasy. It's about Britain's mythical past. It's set post-Roman. I think I'll probably, you know, it takes me a while to get into anything, really. 40 pages is nothing much. So I think I probably will like it. And it was recommended by someone I would trust to recommend your book.
That's a big thing, isn't it? We have friends we trust and we have friends we don't trust.
Yes, well yes, book-wise. That's correct. So far it started off with these people living in an underground sort of city, an underground town. It's connected by tunnels. And it's an elderly couple who are setting off from that place to go and look for a son that you're not actually sure if he even exists, because everyone in Britain is under the influence of this quite sort of mysterious amnesia. So they no one can really remember anything much at all about what's happened in the past. So I think it's going to be a lot about relationships, love, and memory, and perhaps the elusiveness of memory. But I'm just guessing on that at this point.
So was the theme of last week's book, memory,
wasn't it? Oh yes. Historical novels last week, and the week before, it was the
Sebastian
Faulks.
That was all memory.
Yes. one of my favourite books. Megan, what have you been reading?
I have begun Hope Farm by Peggy Frew.
Oh, yes.
Which won Stella Prize, I believe, last year.
Yes.
It's only her second novel, and I didn't enjoy her first, but someone has recommended this one to me saying, no.
Trusted
friend. They had like me, they had read both and agreed that the first one wasn't as good. But it's quite good. It's, again, a split narrative, which I love, but it's a mother and daughter.
Mother
just has very simple diary entries from when she was a teenager and obviously conceived the 13-year-old daughter who tells the other half.
Interesting.
Just a nice view, set back in around about the 80s. Mm. Mother sort of has moved to a commune farm that's quite run down, but it sounds horrible at the start. She hates the new man in the mother's life, and at the age of 13, she's just starting to see her mother as an adult. But no, it's written quite well. I'm enjoying it.
Well, I'm pleased to say, after Sebastian Faulks' Where My Heart Used to Beat, that I have read something frivolous. And I haven't got it with me, but it's Tony Jordan, who's a Melbourne novelist, and it's called Our Tiny Useless Hearts. And the phrase means in context, our tiny useless hearts, which are not very good at loving people. And it's comedy about suburban family in Eltham or somewhere. And it's basically about three married couples, and it's a farce. You know, people arrive on the doorstep at inopportune times, and children make revelations to adults who are shocked and turn on each other, and people decide that they've had enough of their marriage and go off and do something, and then, you know. Anyway, it's very funny.
Why did you choose Eltham for that?
Well,
don't go into
good point. I think the couples are interesting because there's a sort of very healthy couple, you know, who are out there doing earthy things like pottery and jogging, and they've got all the appropriate gear and all this sort of stuff. And then there's the sort of corporate couple, and then there's the kind of arty couple where he's an historian, and actually the narrator's actually a scientist, which is significant in the end, because anyway, it's a comedy, so all ends well except for one of the characters who doesn't deserve a happy ending. Anyway, I do recommend it, Toni Jordan. And I'm going to meet her on Thursday in Melbourne. And I'm taking my voice recorder, so I might have something from her on this program in the weeks to come.
Excellent.
Toni Jordan. I'm also reading, since you asked, this thing, What I Loved by Siri Hustvedt, which is a novel about New York intellectuals in the 80s and their various career moves and marriages and breakups and that sort of thing and family connections. And I'm really quite enjoying it, quite enjoying it.
Hmm. Fictional, I'm assuming. Fiction, still. Yeah.
What I Loved by Siri Hustvedt. And arriving in the post today was, you heard of the quarterly essay where people write very earnest treatises about various significant things. Well, arriving in the mail today is the Chaser Quarterly.
Oh, I'm laughing already. I haven't even seen it.
So we will say might report on that at a later date.
Okay.
Thank you to Megan Harrison, who's gone now to Vietnam, she tells us, for her mid-year holiday. And taking her place at the microphone with Deb Bradfield is Kathy Donovan. Welcome to the show, Kathy.
Thank you, Brian.
The Untouchables by John Banville. In the 1930s, an educated young English person could easily have been disillusioned with the British class system, with its institutionalised unemployment, with its working poor, could have still been bitter about the First World War, the millions of men callously used as cannon fodder, and bitter about the aftermath when the survivors were often unemployed, poor, neglected, blamed for their protests or going on strike. These bright young men, often at Cambridge University, privileged, living comfortable lives themselves, could quite understandably have been idealistic and sympathetic to the prospect of a society in which workers were treated with a respectful egalitarianism. As in, for example, Russia. As the fascist threat to both communism and to Western Europe intensified and the British government actively sought to appease Hitler's regime of hatred and oppression, it would be unsurprising that many young intellectual Englishmen felt more loyalty to the communist ideal than to their own government. And it's in this environment, this historical context, that the Cambridge Apostles formed as a discussion group, and from there emerged the notorious Cambridge Five. This is the milieu of many novelists, notably John le Carré, whose fictional George Smiley remains loyal to Britain amidst all the treachery of Russian agents in the British Secret Service. And John Banville uses this, of course, for the context for The Untouchable, a fictionalised account of the life and career of Anthony Blunt, the fourth man in the Cambridge Five, after Burgess, Maclean, Philby and Ken Cross. Blunt becomes the fictional Victor Maskell in a portrait of alienation and isolation Deb, what do you make of Banville's portrait of this treacherous man?
He's not at all likable, that's for sure. And to as you were doing that introduction, I was trying to imagine him as this sort of person who was thinking about the proletariat, and I'm struggling with that because really he was such a pompous, I won't go further, pompous something. He's a complex character, however, and yes, we're constantly asking ourselves throughout the book why he would have been, in fact, one of the Cambridge Five at all. He's a very interesting character.
There's a suggestion, I'm sure, that his joining as an agent for the Russians is to him like, feels like being seduced. It almost feels like a sexual thing.
Well, he says to Ms. Vandeleur, who's supposedly his biographer at the beginning, yes, that he didn't spy for Russia. He spied for Europe, for a much broader church. And I wondered whether, you know, you were talking about that Roman a la Clef, or whatever, you know, the
Romana
device.
Clef,
Romana,
yes.
Clef. Whether, because the real spy that it was based on, Anthony Blunt, he was British, whereas he's made Victor Maskell Irish.
Yes.
You know, whether that was a way of masking that whole thing about, you know, well, what does it mean to belong to your country? Why do I have to be loyal to a country? Whether there was some essence of that in Anthony Blunt and what was revealed about the real spy, I don't know. Do you know much about that?
I don't, in fact, but I thought that making him Irish was partly because he's a bit of a compilation character with another person whose name I've forgotten, but it also accentuates the alienation, that the sense that he doesn't really belong and therefore doesn't really owe any loyalty.
Yes, that
to
is
the
true.
British establishment.
Yeah. All the way through, you get that sense of him not really belonging quite to.
No.
And it's true that he despises the proletariat, but he also despises the British aristocracy, doesn't he? He despises everybody.
Yeah, I think he does really sort of accept himself, you know.
Yeah. He was very self-loving. He always found a good way to explain away his reasoning and why he was doing things. Going back to your question, you know, he says, I often think how differently things would have gone for me if I hadn't encountered Felix Hartmann when I did. Naturally, I fell a little in love with him. And then, you know, we emerge later on into his discovery of himself as a homosexual in the intimacy of the bombing and all that sort of thing. So, I guess there was some of that.
So becoming a spy is perhaps part of the process of finding your true self in a ironic sort of a way.
Yeah, well, I wondered whether he's sort of like a dichotomy, really, because he was Irish, but he was English. He was a father, but he was also, he was really bisexual. He was a betrayer, and he was duped. It was just double everything, really, including a sort of, well, he wasn't a double agent, but yes.
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 And
he says too, he says, I knew I was being recruited. It was exciting and alarming and slightly ludicrous, like being summoned from the sideline to play in the senior school game. It was amusing. And, just the whole weight of betraying your company, your whole country as amusing is a stunning motive, really.
Yes.
Which brings us to the Guy Burgess character, Boy Bannister, because it just seems to be all a bit of a lark for him, doesn't it?
Oh, an absolute lark. In fact, I think really it seemed like a bit of a lark, certainly for those two characters. Yeah, he talks about when they first wanted him to go off to Moscow to do some particular job, he was talking about how excited they were and what a sort of a great romp it was going to be. And so it was a bit sort of like a boy's own adventure.
Yes.
And he actually talks about it that way. He says that it was essentially a frivolous impulse and a flight from boredom and a search for diversion. The life of action, heedless, mind-numbing action, that is what I had always hankered for, yet I had not succeeded in defining what for me might constitute action until Felix turned up.
Yes. Felix, like all the characters in here, Deb, is kind of memorable. I'll just give you some of the imagery of Felix Hartmann. Hartmann had a peculiar way of holding a cigarette in his left hand between the third and middle fingers and cocked against his thumb, so that when he lifted it to his lips he seemed to be not smoking but taking a tiny sip of something from a slim white phial, a standing shape of smoke the same shade of silver grey as the aeroplane that was gone now, drifted sideways away from us on the pulsing light of noon. And of course this man drives a splendid motor car as well, and I mean it's all, in a way it's all sort of high camp, isn't it, the whole scene?
Oh well it is actually. Yeah. One of the when we were talking about doing this book, I'd read it like 6 months ago, and in fact I couldn't remember this you know, the details of the story that well, because for me Banville, if listeners haven't read him before, to me it's really all about the prose. I just find him an absolute master of the English language. He is really incredible. But just on that high camp bit, you know, I thought, oh, well, I'll go through and I'll just pick out a few quotes. But what happened was I just wanted to read the whole page again, because really I could have quoted the entire page, you know, just as what you read out then, because every single sentence is an absolute masterpiece. But on the high camp bit, there was one point where I think the woman who's writing the book or interviewing him says, "Did men die because of you?" And he said, "Yes, dearie, swooned quite a way." Which I really loved.
Yes.
But, you know, you could, as I say, you could just quote sentence after sentence, paragraph after paragraph. So I'm going to read it again now, because I got so excited when I started back on it to try and find these quotes. I couldn't put it down, so I was reading page after page.
Well, the blurb talks about it being, you know, really humorous and very funny. And, of course, the subject matter is not humorous or funny. It's more dramatic and a thriller in terms of subject matter. So, yeah, you're dead right. It was the prose. And I laughed my way through a lot of it. I found it so witty and so well.
Oh, it really is witty, yes.
And he must have really studied as an author the language of the time. So, you know, when you talk about someone being dead drunk, you know, he talks about them being tight, you know, which is very
much the
language of that era. And all through, he just had plenty.
Yes. Well, I just wonder when he writes, like, how long does it take him to write a sentence? You know, he must think of every way he could possibly make it really interesting. Yeah. And I'd love to hear him being interviewed to see if he actually speaks anything like the way he writes, because it really is extraordinary. There was, and that humorous bent is just, it's true, it runs all the way through it. And there was a, you know, just describing a telephone even, he says, "The telephone ringing gave me a dreadful start. I have never got used to this machine, the way it crouches so malevolently, ready to start clamouring for attention when you least expect it." You know, just a telephone call. We've got a really humorous paragraph.
A lot of the humour, though, comes from the sardonic attitude of the characters. And that this is the kind of complacent world of the English well-to-do.
Yes,
the people who come out of university and then they pick, do you go to the Foreign Office or perhaps you go into intelligence, you know. And I mean, the world's at their feet, and they, you know, they can swan about London, you know, staggering from one cocktail party to the next.
Yes, well, that is also the thing, that He felt invincible, really, and he was. I mean, they actually knew about his dealings for a long time before he was exposed. Yes. He was, in fact, the art curator to the Queen.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
And remained so for years.
They knew in 1964, the actual spy Blunt, they knew in 1964 that he'd committed these crimes, that M15 had interviewed him, but he was given immunity by the Attorney General, and so it wasn't until it came out in a journalist's book that he was exposed in 79.
Yes.
But that is that life of privilege. You know, I can do whatever I like and, you know, I've got connections and...
And in fact, he was.
Well, for 15 years, he got away with it.
And he was a confidant of, you know, the Queen Mother and George VI. He was actually, you know, socialised with them.
Yeah.
Should tell listeners perhaps that the form, the narrative form of the book is at the start, he's been exposed this by Mrs. Thatcher, but was it 1979? And of course, his first reaction is, well, who's betrayed me? and then, of course, he has to cope with, you know, the change from being this privileged person to whom a lot of deference is shown to being vilified and identified in the street and abused, and he can't go out of his house, so he's in this sort of state of shock. And then Miss Van der Leer finally prompts him to tell the story, and she keeps pressing the question, why did you do it? Why did you become a spy? And the book is actually his various answers to that question.
Yes.
It's as if he doesn't know himself.
No. Yeah. No, I don't think he does.
Because his whole identity has been built on lies. He doesn't know who he is, really.
And he finds his double life liberating and exhilarating, and his secret identity as a spy parallels his experience as a closet homosexual in an age when illicit sex carried similar threats of exposure and ruin as, you know, treachery did.
Probably worse than being a spy, actually.
And the crisis of his life comes when he's exposed as a secret agent, is vilified, scorned and rejected. And his Soviet masters and his former conspirators offer little consolation. So you do get this sense, not only of Victor Maskell, but all of them, that they all end up ultimately very lonely.
And they betray each other.
Yes.
Yeah, there's no trust between them. Yeah.
This is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. My name's Brian Dwyer. I'm speaking with Kathy Donovan and Deb Bradfield about John Banville's The Untouchable, which is a roman eclef about the life of Victor Maskell, who is a character based on the Cambridge spy Anthony Blunt. Just to finish this discussion off, Kathy, the sense of betrayal permeates this book, doesn't it? A couple of twists at the end that he finds that even perhaps with his favourite piece of art, perhaps somebody's tricked him.
Yeah.
Perhaps. And the people that he felt that he could rely on, Nick, whom he's adored all his life.
He was in love with, really.
Yes.
He was in love with Nick and then married Nick's sister for some reason. And don't you love it? He rings her up to propose to her and she thinks about it for a minute and says, oh, all right, and hangs up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they were a funny bunch of people, that's for sure.
And in the face of the objections of her family, he still goes ahead and marries her just because he feels he doesn't want to be thwarted.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Self-indulgent.
Yeah.
To the end. The other question that many other people have asked is, how on earth could this have happened? Like the really, Philby was a Russian agent for 30 years, head of counter-Soviet intelligence. Burgess and MacLean were, you know, had access to all kinds of information for how long? More, well, 20 years before, you know, the heat came on them and they fled with the help of Anthony Blunt. And the question that keeps occurring to me throughout the book is, how on earth could this have happened? And perhaps it's because of the complacency of the British aristocracy and the upper middle classes, where so much cronyism, you know, and, oh, he's a good chap, you know. And
exactly.
Well, John le Carré explored that as well. And, yes. and it was very much that if you were of the aristocracy, you could be trusted. You yes. were obviously going to be for king and country, and you were going to uphold,
yes.
you know, all that was good and right.
It's as if they never questioned, never considered that anybody might question their values.
The word of a gentleman.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. The reviews of this book are interesting. I read quite a few online. I don't know if you came across a man called Mark Saunders, but he found this interesting in the book, that Maskell says to Miss Vandeleur, who's interrogating him, "Neither do I want to fashion for myself yet another burnished mask. Having pondered for a moment, I realise that the metaphor is obvious. Attribution, verification, restoration. I shall strip away layer after layer of grime, the toffee-coloured varnish and caked soot left by a lifetime of dissembling, until I come to the very thing itself and know it for what it is, my soul, myself."
Yes, I remember that quote, actually. And that's, again, well, that there's that we I don't think we've mentioned this, that there is an art theme running throughout the book too. He is the art historian, and I think we mentioned the painting that he adored.
Death of Seneca by Poussin.
Yes. Mm. That was really more important to him. I think also at one point he was, I think he was in some sort of terrible strife. Yeah. I can't remember what it was. And he didn't think of his children or wife. He thought of that painting. Yeah, that painting was the most important thing to him. And actually, just on the painting, I did have, when he found it, I just wanted to read out this quote too, because it just, again, gives you an idea of this amazing writing. When he first found it, he said, "There it was, in its chipped gilt frame, with a cracked coat of varnish that made it seem as if hundreds of shriveled toenails had been carefully glued to the surface." What an image is that? Hundreds of shriveled toenails. Yes.
It's just fabulous.
Yeah.
Kathy, you mentioned his the fact that he tried mathematics at university and failed.
Yes, he was a failed mathematician, and he tried, and somewhere in the book there's a piece about how he wanted to reinvent himself, and he spent many years, you know, working on himself to reinvent himself, and then he was sort of discovered and became this Cambridge spy. And I wonder whether he actually ever knew who he really was, because he was constantly reinventing himself.
Now that might be a nice note to end on. This is from the novel, "It is hard for anyone who's not given himself wholeheartedly to a belief to appreciate how the believer's conscious mind can separate itself into many compartments containing many conflicting dogmas. These are not sealed compartments. They're like the cells of a battery over which the electrical charge plays, leaping from one cell to another, gathering force and direction." That's Banville.
Yeah.
His imagery is fabulous.
Oh, yeah. Every single thing, everything he describes is just this wonderful picture of it. In just a few sentences, you can see it.
So it's a joy to read. It is a bit of a page turner. It's a bit of a thriller.
Yes, although as I suppose harping on about this a bit, but I've read three Banville books, and look, most of them I couldn't tell you what the story was about. I just get so caught up in that prose that it just sort of flows. I just get taken along like a tide with it, really.
Well, I'm going to read The Sea. Because
I've read that one.
When I was chasing down this book, I went into a bookshop and one of the people at work there said to me, "But why aren't you reading The Sea? It's such a much better book, you know."
That was my introduction to Banville, actually, and I have got it at home somewhere. One of the quotes I remember from that was him describing people as superannuated boy scouts.
Well, perhaps that will be the topic of another book show on this program. Thank you, Kathy Donovan and Deb Bradfield.
Thanks, Mark.
This is the book show on Apollo Bay Radio. Joining me now at the microphone, Lynn Halloran from Galapagos Books. Hello, Lynn.
Hello.
And Robin Tidball from the Apollo Bay College. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Brian.
Lynn, you've got some titles there in front of you. You've got a few to recommend to me, have you?
I have, because I've only just started to read another one, so I couldn't really do a current read. I'm only about 2 pages in. So what I did was I just grabbed a few that I have read recently. One of them is actually by a local author, Peter Edwards. People may have seen Peter down at our local foreshore markets. Last few weeks, he's actually been handing out this book or having it there, and he's also got a new one which I will review once I've had a chance to read it. This particular one is called Bush Boer's Dark Secrets. Subtitle is I'll Regret My Actions Until My Dying Day. It is actually set in the Otways, which I found rather interesting. Just to give it a little brief précis, I suppose, it's a bit of a snapshot of the choices that the youth make. It's set about some boys. It's actually, the story is told in when a chap is on his deathbed, he actually goes back to something that occurred when he was a teenager and he talks about it or, you know, confesses. The whole book is kind of, children are faced with issues that are in many ways they're not of their own making. You don't realise that perhaps until the end of the book, which is rather good.
Oh.
But they have to face the consequences of the actions that they take when they're dealing with them. Probably if, could be for the teenage market and an adult definitely, be aware of the language. It does have current young boy language in it. But it is the way that children speak. So.
And that's, the author is Peter Edwards.
Peter Edwards, and he's actually from Torquay.
Right.
So, a really
and
good book.
Title again?
Title is Bush Boer's Dark Secrets.
Right.
And another one that I've got, I've just got three that I'm doing. Another one very quickly, quite different, is called The Ballroom by Anna Hope. Very, very quickly, I rather enjoyed this because I like anything that kind of sort of gets into people's minds, I suppose. And a quick précis of this one is it's set in 1911 in Yorkshire. It's actually set in a mental asylum, which is probably the wrong term because the asylums as such in those days weren't really because of issues necessarily of mental health. It was more if you were down and out on your luck, you were put into these places because it was an easier place to keep you. It actually, the top story is a couple that meet in there and their story, but probably the understory is the era's perception of madness and sanity. And more so too, who gets to choose which is which.
Yes.
And the circumstances definitely dictating. So I rather enjoyed that because it was a very interesting look at human nature.
And that's the...
The Ballroom.
The Ballroom.
By Anna Hope. The last one I've got is one that is starting to get a little bit of momentum around. It's called The Dry by Jane Harper. It is an initial novel by this lass. She was actually a print journalist, 13 years working in the United Kingdom and Australia. This particular novel did win the 2015 Victorian Premier's Award for an unpublished manuscript. Mm. I believe that it is actually up for a film, which, you know, so often they do, by Reese Witherspoon. a little bit concerned from my point of view if it is, because I don't like Americans doing Australian stories, and this is an amazing Australian story. It is basically a small farming community. The prejudices that arise in them, very quickly a police investigator goes home to a town that he left when he was a young lad for the funeral of a childhood friend, or a very good friend. This chap actually killed himself and his family in a drought-ravaged community. So it seems very sad and very straightforward in the initial thing because of the circumstances and the trouble the whole town is facing. But is it? And then it goes on to kind of investigate that particular story and also the story that happened to these children when they were younger. So lots of small town prejudices, lots of very, very good Australian, really excellent, definitely recommend it. Well written.
The Dry.
The Dry by Jane Harper.
By Jane
Harper.
Harper.
Excellent.
And for the first time on The Book Show, Robin Tidball. So nice to have you here, Robin.
Lovely to be here, Brian.
You're the librarian at the Apollo Bay Peter 12 College. Now, Peter 12, you must have all kinds of books from prep to year 12.
We have an amazing range of books. My particular favourites are the picture books, but yes, I'll speak about that later on. We've got 17,000 bibliographic records, which really only indicates a title entry for each work. So when we have multiple copies of things like the Treehouse series by Andy Griffiths, we're looking at six copies. So that number would increase quite substantially if we investigated it. Of those 17,000 bibliographic records, 3,090 are for series entries. Mm. And that's what we're finding that the children absolutely love.
Isn't it great? They get a taste and then they sort of, you know, they keep going. It sustains them for a year or two.
Bit like collecting football cards, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are the popular
series? The popular ones, a lot of them have stood the test of time. With our younger readers, particularly the girls, they like a quirky little fairy named Pearlie by Wendy Harmer. There's half a, there's probably 10 to 14 in the series now.
Yeah.
Girls can't get enough of fairies. Then we have the diaries, the Ella diaries, which are relatively new by Meredith Costain. And then Ella must be a popular name because we have Ella and Olivia by Yvette Poshoglian. And then we go back for the boys. It's always hard to get the boys interested. Zach Power has resurfaced.
Oh, yes, I remember Zach Power.
The boys absolutely love him. I must admit, now, the girls give him a wide berth.
are these illustrated?
No, no. Or we don't Zach have Power, the graphic illustrated copies. Then the middle readers, the Treehouse ones, of course, by Andy Griffiths. And I just noticed in a bookselling magazine that he topped the bestsellers list with the 65-story Treehouse in 2015. 312,000 copies were sold.
In Australia. Mm-hmm. That is phenomenal.
It's massive.
And
massive.
Lynn, you would carry the Andy Griffiths stuff.
I carry all of them because, you know, there are those that sort of are beginning, so they want them right from the start. But, yeah, there's probably the best support I ever had was I had a lad who came in February and said, can I please order the next issue? I said, they don't come out till August. But such is the dedication they have to the series. It's fantastic. Yes.
You get these publishing phenomena, don't you? There was, do you remember Jennings, you know, with the...
Very much.
Children are still reading Jennings.
Yeah, Jennings.
His quirky tales are just ageless.
And Marsden, of course, was very popular for, I don't know if he still is, but
he still is, actually. I still get people coming in for the war series.
The war series.
Yep.
Tomorrow when the war began.
Tomorrow when the war began.
Et cetera, about six or seven in the series.
It sort of seems to almost be a generational thing in that, you know, when the next generation comes, it's the rite of passage to start reading those particular books, which I think is brilliant.
Yeah.
And that's what our 11-year-olds plus are reading, that dystopian genre, but, you know, world can't get any worse, can it?
Yeah. Exactly. I think that's the way they feel.
There's a range here. I've just popped a few down in that area. Sort of, it's a bit like fantasy meets sci-fi with kick-ass
characters, usually a female protagonist, which is interesting because the boys are reading them even though they've got that female in the lead. Of course, you've got the Hunger Games, you've got the Divergent series, but there is a title or two titles by Amy Tintira, one called Reboot and the other called Rebel. And
I've heard of these.
Amazing stories. The characters die and they're rebooted.
Yeah.
So if you've been dead for 24 minutes, you have 24 tattoos on your wrist. Now, the longer you've been dead and resuscitated, so if you're 160 hours, you lose your empathy. So when you've been rebooted, you're this harsh character who shows no empathy towards anybody else. And, of course, they're the ones that are in charge of the lower numbered and rebooted characters.
Sounds intriguing. And
is there some diabolical force controlling all of this?
Of course.
Yes.
And they're always adults.
And evil
genius. We are evil. We are evil adults.
And then the other genre, of course, when I say genre, doesn't really attract me terribly much. Romance set in the American college scene, the John Green books.
Oh, yeah.
Our teenagers can't get enough of them.
I say very popular, have been very popular.
Right.
I can't quite understand it,
what?
But I try to push them in the direction of some of the Australian authors that we have.
Monique, who's a regular on this program, perhaps on work experience this week, I think. Hello, Monique. She talks about the young adult fiction, but perhaps for, you know, 16, 17-year-olds, where social issues are tackled. You know, there's, you know, whether it's family breakups or drug addiction or loneliness or whatever it is. And that it just seems to me that the younger audiences don't go for those. The younger kids, they tend to like, well, I don't know, do they like the fantasy or the
it's a hard question to answer, Brian, because you've got some children that like the diary stories, the contemporary stories, like The Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Then you have children who love fantasy. Sometimes it's about matching the right book with the right child at the right time. If you mention fantasy to a lot of children, they don't quite understand what fantasy is about and they refuse immediately to even try it. But we just have to coax them into it. It's an interesting concept. The series I've jotted down here that has worked really well with some of the reluctant readers and has got them hooked is two titles by Lizzie Wilcock, Extinction and Extinction 2. Everybody I've given it to has enjoyed it, both books, and when they've got to the last chapter in Extinction 2, they've said, Robin, where's the next one? We can't put it down.
Isn't that great when you get a reluctant reader going? Did we talk about Diary of a Wimpy Kid?
Not really.
Not one of your favourites?
No. Quirky. Throw in Tom Gates along with Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Lynn, wouldn't you?
Definitely.
great for kids. Yeah. They can't get enough of them. But you often find when they get to number 8 or 9, they become a little bit more discerning about what they want to read. And maybe we're a bit bored with this format now.
Yeah, it sort of tends to be a little bit familiar.
Drops off.
Yes. Well, I'm hoping that there might be a market for perhaps a bit of gritty realism in children's literature, and we'll talk about that on another day.
That would be fabulous.
I'll put these titles on the website. That's Apollo Bay Radio. Thank you to the listeners. Thank you very much for your company tonight. Thanks to Megan Harrison, Deb Bradfield, Kathy Donovan. Thank you very much, Lynn Halloran.
Thank you for having me.
Thank
and happy
you,
reading.
Robin Tidball.
Thank you for having me too.
You're listening to Apollo Bay Radio.